So I'll talk about the shape dependence. So the average null energy condition will be the subject. So this is work that I'm doing with people from Illinois, Rob Lee, Onkar Parikh, Hua Zhao Wang. And it's also somewhat related to some earlier work that I did here. And it hasn't come out yet, hopefully soon. So the basic idea here is, or the basic goal is, I think we should try to study the entanglement structure of quantum field theories in some detail, and use this to constrain quantum field theories themselves. Okay, so entanglement, you know, satisfies these powerful inequalities like strong subadditivity, relative entropy monotonicity, and so forth. And these are basically just a consequence of unitarity. But it turns out when you combine them with Lorentz invariance and causality, they actually lead to a slew of powerful results that we already know. So for example, the C theorem in two dimensions and the F theorem in three dimensions can be proven using entanglement entropy, and in particular the strong subadditivity bound. And so these are constraints on quantum field theories and how quantum field theories flow from one fixed point to the other fixed point. They also give bounds on the propagation of entanglement. So here's just a random list. This is not complete. They give bounds on the localization of negative energy density. I'll talk a bit more about this later. And also interestingly, when you sort of weakly couple the quantum field theory to gravity, they can give you constraints on that. So you get sort of gravitational constraints like the Bekenstein bound, generalized second law, and the Busse bound. I'll also talk a bit more about these later. So the idea, so constraining quantum field theories, what might we want to do? Well, maybe we want to constrain the data of the quantum field theory, and here I'm imagining, say, maybe the couplings of the theory. We know some couplings of say, the quantum field theory are constrained, even a low-energy effective quantum field theory, like the higher derivative couplings, or the signs are constrained, and so forth. But you know, for this talk, I'm going to actually concentrate on CFT data, so we can also define, you know, sort of a quantum field theory by its, if it's conformal by just a list of data, in particular the scaling dimensions of various primary operators, and the OPE coefficients, the three-point functions in the CFT. But to relate this stuff to the entanglement structure that I wanted to use and all the powerful inequalities, we need new and better methods to actually calculate entanglement in terms of this data, so to relate it to this data. And so that's going to be part of the goal of this talk. Right now, all we have available to us are sort of free fields. We can understand the entanglement structure of free fields really well. Numerics, you can make some progress with numerics. And in certain highly symmetric situations, we also have results.
Tom?
Yeah.
So you said all those nice properties follow from, you know, just unitarity, Lorentz invariance, and very general properties of the quantum. So when you say constraining quantum field theory, you mean choosing couplings or scaling dimensions so that the theory is
consistent
unitary?
With that. Yeah. Right. And we know that sometimes it's not, right? We have examples like that. I think if you have the wrong sine high derivative coupling, then you can have a causal effects in the theory, for example. We can also calculate entanglement entropy in ADS CFT, and this is, you know, because we know this, we can actually get a lot of constraints, for example, on the bulk gravitational theory, and this has been a useful thing to do. I want to sort of learn more not using ADS CFT. Okay, and so how I'm going to do this is to try to prove something called the averaged null energy condition. So this is the following statement. So in particular in Minkowski space. So the statement is I'm going to use some property of entanglement, so the monotonicity of relative entropy, to show that the following integral is positive in any state. So if I take some state and I calculate the null components of the stress tensor in some direction, and I integrate them over a null geodesic, so this is the Penrose diagram of Minkowski space, and this is some null geodesic like this, Then the average null energy condition in Minkowski space tells us that this should be positive. Okay, so now, the background to this, which I don't know much about, and there are tons of experts in the audience, so but I'll say a little bit is basically, if you just look at gravity coupled to classical field theory, then you can prove a lot of results about sort of the dynamics of that gravity just based on the fact that the null energy condition is true, which is the statement that T++ is positive locally without this integral. But it turns out in quantum mechanics this is not true. Locally this can be negative, but it seems in many examples using, say for example, free quantum field theory, you can show that the integral of this is positive, and that's sufficient to prove all sorts of interesting things about the dynamics of gravity coupled to that theory. Of course, in that case, you need to know more than this. You need to know about the average null energy condition in more general spacetimes. But that's
Your notation implies two dimensions. You can just do two dimensions?
This is in general dimensions. Yeah. So my Penrose diagram, I guess, implies two dimensions, but don't think of it that way. Think of folded it out. So.
And remind me, this is a known result in two-dimensional theories, but in higher dimensions it was not previously proven?
Yeah, so it has been proven by Aaron Wall for free theories and I guess super normalizable theories.
Right.
But in general, yeah. So there's all sorts of interesting reasons to study this from the gravitational point of view, but also just when you apply this bound to conformal field theories, you can get constraints on the OPE coefficients, so the three-point functions of the CFT, and this is the subject of Hoffman-Molesina. These are sometimes called the conformal collider bounds. So the idea in that paper was to study a different quantity, which is some kind of energy flux at infinity. So imagine an observer that's sort of moving very far away from some event or some state that you create by acting with an operator on the vacuum, and then collecting the energy that's radiated out in some particular direction. So we define this operator, which depends on the direction. And you would kind of expect that this should be positive, okay? And based on that expectation, which they didn't prove, they showed that you could constrain the three-point functions. And this is really easy to see, because the state that they're looking at is the vacuum, an operator just acting on the vacuum. This quantity, which is the expectation value of some stress tensor, in this state is a three-point function with T and O, okay? So it's clear that this bound is going to do something non-trivial. And so it turns out that if you think of the operator that's creating the state as the stress tensor in four dimensions, then you can get this nice bound on the A and C trace anomaly coefficients because these are things that appear in the three-point function of the stress tensor. So if I have the three-point function of the stress tensor in a CFT, it's determined by some it's determined by conformal invariance to be, there are three conformally invariant structures that you can write down, and the coefficients of those are undetermined, and those are the OPE coefficients. But this sets a bound on those OPE coefficients. These bounds have been recently proven using other methods, using bootstrap methods, for a particular class of operators acting on the vacuum.
So you're trying to use exactly those bounds?
Yeah. So for where the operator is the stress tensor or a current. This work was initiated by these guys, and then it was sort of proven eventually by these guys. But basically for us, all that matters is via sort of conformal transformation. If I'm working in a CFT, this integral can be moved to this integral. So it's equivalent to the average null energy condition. So if you can show the average null energy condition in Minkowski space, you can show that these bounds are true. So we're kind of going for a different proof. Okay. So, and how are we going to do it? So we're going to think a little bit about modular Hamiltonians in quantum field theory. So let me define what a modular Hamiltonian is. So the idea is sort of the setup for entanglement entropy, for geometric entanglement entropy. I imagine the quantum field theory has some tensor product structure where I have a Hilbert space associated degrees of freedom in some spatial region, say A, and the degrees of freedom outside. And then with this, you can take some state, we'll for the most part take the vacuum, and you can trace over everything outside of this, and you get a reduced density matrix for A. And then the modular Hamiltonian is just the log of that reduced density matrix, okay? That's it. Now, it's sometimes called the entanglement Hamiltonian in condensed matter circles. Its spectrum is related to the Schmidt coefficients, which is sort of how the vacuum state decomposes under this tensor product. And so it gives a sort of detailed entanglement data. If you knew the full spectrum of the entanglement Hamiltonian, then you know basically everything there is to know about entanglement, bipartite entanglement in this case. But another reason it's useful to study is because of relative entropy. So relative entropy has some definition. It depends on two density matrices for the state. So here I have the density matrix of the vacuum and then the density matrix of some excited state. And it's just defined as the change in the expectation value of this modular Hamiltonian in these two different states minus the change in just the usual von Neumann entanglement entropy. Okay, so this is just the definition, but it turns out to have really nice properties. Basically they can be summarized by the fact that relative entropy is some measure of the distinguishability of these two density matrices. If they're the same, then the relative entropy vanishes. So what do we know about modular Hamiltonians? So often it's some horrible non-local object. You're just taking the log of the reduced density matrix. But in some special cases, it simplifies. So if the region of interest is just half of all space, then you get something called the Rindler cut. So R is going to stand for Rindler. So just remember that. So you get for R being this half space, then the modular Hamiltonian has some really nice expression just in terms of an integral of the stress tensor, where you dot it into the boost isometry, and I'll talk more about this, and then integrate it over the spatial region R. And similarly for in CFTs, you can sort of do a conformal transformation on this and move this to a ball-shaped region, and then you have a nice expression for the modular Hamiltonian for ball-shaped regions. Okay, so these are very symmetric situations. There's further results that I won't really go into. For the modular Hamiltonian in the case where the region is some infinitely boosted null slab region, then you can write down an expression for the modular Hamiltonian. And this I'll talk about a little bit. The form of the modular Hamiltonian has been, there's a conjecture for the form of the modular Hamiltonian in holographic theories, which is due to these people, and I'll call this the JLMS modular Hamiltonian, and I'll come back to this. And so we kind of want to add more to this list, right? And so that's the idea. And the reason you might want to add more to this list, well, there's several reasons I told you that we can use, well, okay, so. Yeah. So there are the interesting uses of known modular Hamiltonians. So maybe if we know more about various modular Hamiltonians, then we can apply them to various things. So one thing that you might ask, well, what is the modular energy? What is the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian in some state? What does it mean? So it's some dimensionless quantity. You might think of it as giving a crude upper bound on the entanglement entropy of some excited state, just because the relative entropy, so this quantity that I defined, which is these differences, is a positive quantity, and you can show that. And so that means that the entanglement entropy has to be less. The change in the entanglement entropy has to be less than the change in the modular energy. So it gives some crude measure of the entanglement. And as it's going to turn out, it's easier to calculate. Okay, so that's going to be crucial. Also, in the case where you think about deformations, yeah.
Calculate in general?
Yeah, so in a general state, it's easier to calculate. So entanglement entropy is kind of hard.
In a general region?
No, not a general region. So okay. I'll get to that. Yeah, but yeah. So entanglement entropy is kind of hard to calculate in a general state in many situations. So yeah, but it turns out that this is easier. So okay. So the other use that it's had is the first law of entanglement entropy has some of the statement of the first law of entanglement has some relation to Einstein's equation. So in particular, if I take a linearized deformation of the vacuum state, for example, then because of this positivity bound, at least to linear in order, you have to have the following statement, that the change in modular energy is equal to the change in entropy. And this looks like a first law. And this constraint on holographic theories implies some kind of perturbative Einstein's equations for situations where we know the modular Hamiltonian. It's been used in proofs of the generalized second law for free fields by Aaron Wall and so forth. Okay, and it's also come up for proving something about a constraint on the distribution of negative energy density in some excited state. So these are two papers that are very relevant to this talk. I won't actually go into the details of these papers, but you know they influence this talk, if you like.
Are you
going to
state the results?
Yeah, sort of. Well, maybe not. No, I won't state this result in detail. But I'll state one of their results. Okay, good. So what we want to do is we want to study the shape dependence of modular Hamiltonians. So we want to move away from this Rindler half space cut, and we're going to do it in perturbation theory. So we're just going to move away a little bit from the Rindler cut. So here's a picture of that. So here I'm just drawing sort of the perpendicular directions to the boundary of the region of interest. So in this case R, the boundary lives here at this dot. And so, you know, out of the board are the other directions. Okay, so I'm working in general dimensions. And so this is the Rindler cut here. Now I want to deform this Rindler cut a little bit. Okay, and so now I'm going to talk about a different region, which I'll call A. And this is going to be a function of the transverse directions to the entangling surface. Okay, so this is there's some curve here. And so why is it useful to consider this? Well, there's a powerful result that relative entropy satisfies called monotonicity. So if the region that we're interested in, A, is contained in the previous region, R, or really we should talk about this in terms of causal domains. So if the domain of dependence of A is contained in the domain of dependence of the Rindler cut, then the relative entropy actually has to decrease. And intuitively, this is easy to understand. Basically, as I told you, the relative entropy gives you a measure of the distinguishability of these two density matrices. If I throw out some of the information of this density matrix, the relative entropy has to go down because I can distinguish them less. So for example, if I have this situation where I have some matter coming in at the speed of light in this direction, then when I sort of trace out this information, I don't see it anymore, and the relative entropy should vanish. Okay, so it went from something which is, say, positive here to zero. And yet, you know, it's easy to state like this, but actually it's still hard to prove. You can actually prove strong subadditivity with this, and strong subadditivity, as you know, is hard to prove. But right now, it depends on the entanglement entropy, and I also told you that entanglement entropy is hard to calculate. But there's a nice trick, which is due to, well, I read it first in this paper by Cassini and Blanco. I don't know what that's doing there. I guess I forgot to. But you know, it seems to have permeated Aaron Wall's thinking since at least 2010. So I'll go through the argument and then you can see. So basically, the idea is to apply this monotonicity argument to the relative entropy. So here's the application of the monotonicity argument to the region. So A, which is shrinking, and this is the Rindler cut. And you want to also apply it to the complement. But so where we take the complement of A, but now because the complement of A is actually increasing because we're deforming it the other way in some sense, the inequality goes the other way. And then it's useful to find something called the full modular Hamiltonian, which is the difference between the modular Hamiltonian of the region A minus the modular Hamiltonian of the complement region. And if you like, I should probably tensor in unit operators here in the appropriate fashion. But so once you've defined this, you take these two inequalities, you subtract them because they go the other way. You use purity of the entanglement entropy, so we're just going to look at pure states. And the fact that this full modular Hamiltonian annihilates the vacuum state for both A and R. And this magically implies the following inequality. So it implies that the expectation value in a general state of the difference in the full modular Hamiltonian for the region A minus the full modular Hamiltonian for the original Rindler space cut is negative, right? So that means that this operator, because this is true for any state, is a negative semi-definite operator. So this is nice, and this has been applied in various ways. So Cassini and Blanco applied this to sort of modular Hamiltonians for CFTs for ball-shaped regions and got interesting results.
Sorry, did this use the fact that the state is the modular Hamiltonian of the vacuum that we're
talking about? Yeah, so that's here. So both of them are the modular Hamiltonians of the vacuum, just for different regions, but they both satisfy this.
But somewhere in there, the properties of the vacuum state were used. I could have done this. I could have imagined setting this up, modular Hamiltonians for different state, and the full modular Hamiltonian would still annihilate that state.
So I think this argument goes through for that. The only question is whether the state is pure. If the state isn't pure, then you get something over here which you can show is negative in it.
But in the case where, I'm also confused, one thing I can do is just displace R so it's another Rindler wedge.
Yeah.
And in that case, there's still a sign here because it's this guy, it's not the other guy.
So the sign is fixed by the fact that I'm thinking about Ka minus the complement of Ka.
And A is contained in R.
Yeah, and that A is contained in R. So yeah, that's important. So the claim is...
But is the statement just that if I have any state and I think about the modular Hamiltonian defined by that state in some region,
yeah,
and I move to a smaller region, I'll have a similar... relationship, or does one of them really have to be a Rindler wedge?
No. This is a very general statement. It's going to be useful in the case where we know at least one of these modular Hamiltonians to begin with. Okay. So it's very general.
It's really the statement that if you shrink the region, the expectation of modular Hamiltonian has to go down.
The full modular Hamiltonian, yes.
The full modular Hamiltonian, yes.
Which is kind of, in some sense, really the thing that's well defined in the quantum field theory. But yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So the claim is that we can do an explicit field theory, sort of perturbation theory calculation, to show that this difference, so the difference between the full modular Hamiltonian for the deformed region minus this Rindler full modular Hamiltonian, is the following. So it's some integral. So we have some integral over of the null stress tensor T++ integrated over one horizon, say H plus, so the full horizon, so it's the union of these two, and T minus minus integrated over this horizon, okay, plus order delta x squared corrections. Okay, so this is true to linear order in the deformation, and so you see, now if I impose that A had to be contained in R, just because of the way I've defined my light-like coordinates x plus and x minus, that means delta x plus is greater than zero, delta x minus is less than zero. And so because this had to be a negative semi-definite operator, this has to be a positive operator, and this has to be a positive operator. And also because these deformations are general deformations, so they just depend on some function of the transverse directions. That means that for each sort of null generator of this horizon, I have the average null energy condition. Is that clear?
You're integrating not only over the boundary of the Rindler wedge, but over the other side as well. You say this H plus.
Yeah, and H plus. Yeah. So the full thing. So this is a full. Yeah. So this is a complete null geodesic.
Complete null.
Yeah, null surface. Yeah. And the reason you get these two is because it's the full module Hamiltonian, so it's the difference. Okay.
I'm not sure how this calculation goes. Why does it work that way?
Yeah.
Why should you be integrating over points that are far from the region of interest?
So actually, this is why, and I'm going to go through the details of this calculation, and I apologize to everyone for that in advance. Yes, if I have time. And partly that's because we do this calculation, and I don't fully understand why it happens, but it happens. Okay, and so I'll tell you how it happens, and then maybe you can tell me why it happens.
Are we done with the argument then?
Well, so this proves, if you can show this fact, which I haven't shown, but I'll give sketch some argument how we show this, then this proves the average null energy condition in Minkowski space.
But we're averaging over two entire horizons and not just geodesics.
That's right, but because these are arbitrary functions of the transverse direction, I can pull that out.
Oh, I see. So delta x plus and delta x minus are independent.
Yeah, so they're, yeah. Oh, yeah, and these two are independent. Yeah, I mean, if you like, you can just cross one of these out.
And delta x plus is only a function of the transverse?
It's only a function of the transverse.
So you can't localize piece of the horizon?
It's only defined here, right? We're only deforming this region.
I see.
So this shape dependence, so the idea of studying shape dependence actually, it comes from the following. So basically from previous work. So we're going to use a perturbative approach, and these are actually well-developed calculations. So there's now, quite a few papers on studying sort of perturbative approaches to entanglement entropy, studying with Vladimir and Misha Smolkin. Obviously, we're doing perturbation theory. So the starting point, as with any perturbation theory, has to be some solvable case. And so that's why we're doing small deformations of the rimless space cut. And we can also do generalizations if we do the ball in the CFT. But let's not talk about that. Let's talk about that now. one notable success we've had with this is studying the shape dependence of entanglement entropy. So this is not the module energy. This is just the vacuum entanglement entropy of a CFT. If I have a ball-shaped region, which I told you I know what the module Hamiltonian is in that case, and then I deform it slightly, and in particular, I'm going to sort of deform it at two places. And then you define the following quantity. And you can think of this quantity as basically the second functional derivative of the entanglement entropy with respect to the shape deformation. You might notice that this is the strong subadditivity bound, so this has to be positive by strong subadditivity. You can argue that it has the following form, and people have called it this quantity n, the entanglement density. So it depends on the deformation at B and the deformation at C, and then you have this thing there. We showed using this perturbative approach that this n can be calculated, and it depends on Ct, which is the coefficient of the stress tensor two-point function. So if I have a two-point function in general dimensions, it has the following form, and it's just known up to some coefficient, which is Ct. And this form is just fixed. You can argue it's fixed by conformal invariance. So it depends on x1, x2 are sort of points on the ball, if you like. So confused. So x1 and x2 are just points on the ball. A result agrees with ADS CFT. So you can just do this calculation in ADS CFT, and this is what you find. And note that the strong subadditivity bound, which I told you is powerful, bound CT to be positive. But we already knew that, so it's not anything new. Okay. That was just some background to this calculation. So now I'm going to sketch this calculation for the modular Hamiltonian. This is what we're aiming for. And I apologize for the details. Okay, so I have to tell you how to do this. Basically, there's two steps I have to tell you. So the shape deformation that we're going to get it via a diffeomorphism. So a diffeomorphism then couples to the stress tensor, and that's why we're getting stress tensors here. Okay. roughly speaking. And then I also have to tell you how to do perturbation fit theory for density matrices. So you have to take the log of rho plus a deformed density matrix. And that gives you some non-trivial things, which actually turns out to give this sort of null integral. So that's why it's kind of, I find it interesting to go through the calculation. So some of the tools we'll need, well, we're going to basically do things using a Euclidean path integral. So this is pretty standard going, you know, standard Unruh argument. If I have a Rindler space cut here, so here now I'm in Euclidean, I'm drawing the perpendicular directions to the boundary of R. And so my coordinates are going to be, right, so I'll define my coordinates as Z in this plane. Then to define the reduced density matrix for the vacuum, what you have to do is to just do a path integral in this space where you impose boundary conditions on the top and the bottom of this cut, which depend on the two states of the density matrix, so beta and alpha. Okay, and the fact that we're working with a vacuum state is just the fact that we're doing a Euclidean path integral. So in some sense, you know, the Euclidean path integral, say, from negative infinity projects onto the vacuum. Okay. And so as you see, you can think of the reduced density matrix as this path integral, but you can also think of it as just a rotation by 2 pi. And so then you can write this form of the density matrix, where what sits here is 2 pi times kr, where kr is, or I times kr, is something like the rotation generator in the CFT. And then when I wick rotate that, when I put in factors of I appropriately, then this becomes the boost generator that I claimed before, and so that gives us a general expression for the exponential, so for the reduced density matrix, and of course the log of this just gives kr, and that gives you the modular Hamiltonian. Okay. And so with this, it's pretty natural to define something called modular flow. So modular flow is actually defined for just some general reduced density matrix. If I have some operator which acts on the A Hilbert space, I can define this operator just by conjugating O with these factors here. And if I write rho as e to the, you know, k, e to the minus k, where k is the modular Hamiltonian, then this is just like, you know, time evolution with the modular Hamiltonian. Okay. So this is sort of a general thing, but in the case where A is the Rindler cut, then the modular flow is geometric. So what that means is that if I had a local operator to begin with, then I'll get a local operator after I do this modular flow, which is a local operator just located at a point xs, which is related to x by a boost. Right? So k is the boost generator. So up to some factors here, maybe, you know, depending on what kind of operator this is. And one thing that that's kind of obvious is that if I sort of take the modular parameter S, not to be real, but to be imaginary, then I just get a rotation. So modular flow is just rotation in the Euclidean direction. Okay. And often it's actually useful to define modular flow with respect to the full modular Hamiltonian, but that actually doesn't, there's no difference as if this operator is an operator which is acting on just the region A or the Hilbert space of region A. And here's a picture of modular flow in real times. If I have some operator, say, in the R region here, then it'll move up to here by some amount. And then the Euclidean directions you can think of as sort of, you know, the plane sort of coming out of the board. And then instead of, if I do modular flow with respect to some imaginary parameter, then I just get rotations. Okay, is that clear? Okay, and then full modular flow moves you up on one side and down on the other side. Okay, so back to the calculation. Okay, so we want to do this shape deformation. Okay, firstly, you know, so we defined this, for the Rindler space cut, we defined this this path integral. So we can also do that for a deformed region. So here what I'm imagining is instead of, you know, the Rindler cut, I have some other kind of cut. And remember, you know, this, I've factored out this direction. So this region can have some non-trivial profile in the y direction. And so the idea here is I'm just going to do this deformation using z coordinates, and I'm going to define it using these holomorphic delta z bar, and then eventually I'm going to analytically continue these coordinates so that I get something in terms of the light-like coordinates that I was interested in real times. Okay, and so that's how this, roughly how this works up to a sign. So how do we calculate the reduced density matrix for this cut? Well, the idea is to think of this as the reduced density matrix for some non-trivial cut with a flat metric. So here, you know, I'm in Euclidean, so this is just delta, right? And then I'm going to do some diffeomorphism, which essentially takes this region and pushes it back to the Rindler cut, okay? And I'm going to do that at the expense of introducing a non-trivial metric, okay? And so I have some non-trivial metric in this region, some blob region, which, you know, just it can extend a finite amount around the entangling surface. Okay, and then you just expand. Okay, so then you expand in the vector field, the small deformation of this diffeomorphism, and then you get some metric that looks like this. Okay. And so then you can use that to expand the density matrix for the Rindler cut in with this non-trivial metric in some perturbative expansion. And then delta rho is just some integral over the stress tensor with this deformation. Now, to do this, there's a trick that you have to do, which is basically to split the contribution, so to split this integral, which is over this blob-shaped region, into two parts. So we're going to split it into something that looks like this, with a whole cutout and the whole contribution. And the claim is you can show that the whole contribution vanishes in the limit a goes to zero, so we're going to ignore it. And so we're left with an integral over this region. Okay, and then we have this a, which is sort of an imaginary parameter, but we're going to send it to zero at the end.
Now, can I use someone's yeah. example? When you're going on the left for delta rho,
yeah.
Does the ordering of the operators matter, and is there a reason that the stress tensor sits on the right of the...
You should think of this stress tensor as sort of a rotated stress tensor from R by some angle, and then so you have to think about the signs there. But so I can think of this as how should I say this? The order does matter, but it depends on how the signs that you define for sort of time evolution in the angular direction. Does that make sense?
I think what you're telling me is once I would rotate to Lorentz signature, that ordering is not exactly what it looks like.
I'm not going to Wick rotate yet. Okay, so the Wick rotation will be forced upon me. But right now, the ordering doesn't really matter. So if you're worried about other operators, the ordering, it's not an issue yet because I haven't traced this against anything. So there's no reason it should be.
It just looks like it's non Hermitian, but I don't understand what it means that the delta rho is a non Hermitian.
So that depends. That just depends on the details of this deformation, right? Whether it's symmetric or not under sort of time reflection in. Sorry?
Depends on whether it is with your R.
Does it? I don't think so. I mean, it certainly doesn't commute with rho R.
Right. So if I do that as an operator equation, I take the adjoint, then I flip the two order the two operators.
Right. So then you can use some kind of KMS thing to move this around.
Yeah, okay. So it's in that sensor stuff.
Okay, so then we can show that this whole contribution vanishes. We also want to evaluate this modular Hamiltonian in some state. So how are we going to do that? Well, we're going to do it for the following state. So it's just some operator acting on the vacuum, and then we evolve with the CFT Hamiltonian, this is not the modular Hamiltonian, for some amount in Euclidean time, and so that makes this state normalizable. Okay. And then we're going to form a reduced density matrix for that state, which involves doing some trace over AC, and then you can do the same diffeomorphism that we did before to move this to a density matrix for the excited state in the Rindler region with a non-trivial metric. And at the end of the day, you get a picture like this, where we have two operator insertions, and the two operator insertions just come about because we have the Brar and the Ket in this state. Okay.
How do you determine the position of the state?
Of this here?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just this.
OX.
OX, it can be anywhere. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Let's take it to be any spatial point. Right. Okay. But one thing it does require is that this operator is sort of separated from this Diffie morphism, which is reasonable. Okay. I should say whether this is a general statement. So in a CFT, this state by the state operator correspondence is general. In a quantum field theory, you might need some more general thing, but we think the argument should go through for that.
Sure. You say in quantum field theory. Oh, I see. In quantum field theory, it's probably true that any state is superposition of these things, but you're really just taking the expectation that you're in a single session.
No. So in a CFT, that's also true. This is a basis, right? So the state operator correspondence gives you a basis. So it's true we should do this argument with different operators, but it goes through.
Okay. You say in quantum field theory, it's not necessarily even a basis.
Well, I don't really know, but I don't think it really matters. You can imagine just sort of inserting a general state here and here, and probably the argument goes through. But you do have to make it separated from this Diffie morphism, which you can make small, so it's probably fine.
Yeah, you're saying that individual operator should.
Yeah. Exactly. So then we're interested in the expectation value of the module Hamiltonian in this non-trivial state. So this is the trace of the reduced density matrix for this non-trivial state times the modular Hamiltonian. And then we do this Diffie morphism and we relate it to the trace in the presence of these non-trivial metrics. And then we expand, okay? And when we expand, we get two terms. We get one term from expanding this guy and we get one term from expanding this guy. The term we get from expanding this guy is somewhat trivial. It's actually possibly divergent when I take this a goes to 0, and it seems to be divergent if I have an operator which is relevant enough. But it cancels when I take this difference, when I calculate the difference between the modular Hamiltonian of A and the complement. Okay, so basically this term is not there. But the second term is sort of the interesting one, and that's what we're going to concentrate on. Okay, so basically.
The first term is just exactly 0, you're saying. I didn't understand.
So.
Is it just the divergence that cancels the A go to 0? I mean, you're just in the finite A.
So I'm lying a little bit. There's a term here that's important that cancels with a term here, which I'm going to ignore. I'm trying to suppress a few details. Roughly speaking, you can imagine that this term is 0. Not just that the divergence cancels, this term is 0. To show that you use the fact that this annihilates the vacuum. That the Rindler version of this annihilates the vacuum. So you can actually prove that's 0. Not that the divergence cancels, but that it's 0. That this contribution to the deformation is 0. Up to a term which I haven't told you about. I wasn't going to say this, but maybe I can say something about it later. The interesting term is this term. If I expand the log, so I'm imagining expanding the log, then I can write it as log of rho 1 plus rho inverse delta rho. And then this is the log of two matrices, of the product of two matrices. And so if they don't commute, I can't just write it as log A plus log B. And in general, you get sort of an infinite sum, which depends on K. So here I've suppressed R. So all of these rows are for the Rindler cut, and all of these Ks are for the Rindler cut. And so if I just look at all the terms, so the Campbell-Baker-Hausdorff quality is more complicated than this. It includes more contributions. But if I just look at all the terms that have just one delta rho in it, they all look like this, nested commutators, okay. And with some numbers. And I claim that you can sum up all of these contributions into the following form, into an integral over some parameter s times some kernel times the modular flow, rho to the is, of this deformation. Okay. And it's modular flow in real times. Okay, so s is a real parameter. So now this is the term that we're interested in. It looks like this. There's the stress tensor deformation with the diffeomorphism, and we modular flow. We do some modular flow here, and it's integrated over this region. So the term that I'm ignoring is that there's a boundary term that comes from the cut, and this term actually has to cancel because it depends on the deformation away from this region, which has to be zero. So this term, there's a term here which cancels with a term in the other deformation, which right. Which I'm not going to talk about. Sorry. Okay, so now at this point, this is a diffeomorphism, so I can just integrate by parts, and then I use the fact that the stress tensor is conserved, at least in the absence of local operator insertions. And you know, as long as my state, the operator is far away from the operator insertions are far away from the diffeomorphism, this is true. And so at the end of the day, I get an integral which is at the boundary of this hole. Okay, so I've drawn it here, so it's at the boundary of this hole of the stress tensor times some factors here. And then we have to remember this modular flow. Okay. So I'm going to do a few steps here. If you don't follow it, it's okay. I'll make some comments later. So this is an integral over this angular coordinate theta. Actually, I can remove the dependence on theta in the stress tensor. So the stress tensor depends on theta here. Just by a contour deformation of this integral, S integral. So this is, remember, S integral comes with this modular flow. So if I deform S by something like this amount, then I get theta dependence here, and that theta dependence kills the theta dependence in the stress tensor. So with this trick, I can move the stress tensor insertion. So it's only, so in this form, it only acts on the R region, okay, on the spatial region R.
So
at
one point,
it's still integrated along the. Yeah. So I might have, I've suppressed that integral. Sorry.
It's basically at the boundary of the original spatial region.
The boundary of the original spatial region. Yes, close to the boundary.
Yeah.
So it's here. So now we have this stress tensor inserted at this point, but then we have to remember we have to do this modular flow in real times. And so what that does is it moves the operator along the light cone. So in general, it moves along this hyperboloid. Okay, so I think I said that here. So the remaining modular flow moves this operator along this sort of hyperboloid, which is sort of very close to the horizon. Okay. So basically, at the end of this, The takeaway from this is that these non-trivial commutators have forced us to switch the calculation from a Euclidean correlation function, which is integrated over this whole, to a correlation function in real times. And I think this is interesting, but I don't fully understand. So when you do this now, notice that if I go back to this equation here, there's an A sitting out here, so you might say if when I take A to zero, this term just vanishes. But that's not true. There's an enhancement that comes about when you do a modular flow, when your S parameter becomes large. So A is going to zero, so this is actually very large. And when that's happening, when S is minus log A, you've actually liberated the operator from close to this region, and now it's on the horizon. Okay, and when you do this, you get an enhancement, and the A's cancel, and when the dust settles, you get this null energy integral. So the final result is, basically the change in the modular Hamiltonian for region A is the integral. Yeah, so I should have said, maybe I should have said that you should also get a contribution from this here, but it actually, it's zero in the limit A goes to zero. Okay, so at the end of the day, you just get, for at least one of the null deformations, the change in the expectation of the modular Hamiltonian is equal to the expectation value of this null energy operator, which I've defined like this, which is an integral from zero to infinity, plus the other deformation, so the other null deformation contribution. Okay, so then, right, and in this expression there's a possible divergence from that other term that I talked about, but cancels when you calculate the shape deformation of the full modular Hamiltonian. And so the full modular Hamiltonian, you get an integral not from 0 to infinity, but an integral from minus infinity to infinity, and then you get this average null energy condition, and this follows. And this is true, we've shown this to true in a large class of states, likely all of the all states. Actually this argument goes through if I think about null generators of bifurcate killing horizons, then you can basically use the same argument to show that the average null energy condition is satisfied for null geodesics along that horizon.
You say likely all states. I guess I'm confused.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Why do you need the state to be built with a local operator insertion at all?
But at an intermediate step, I get some correlation function, which is a three-point function, yeah. And it's nice to analyze the properties of that three-point function, whether it's convergent and things like that, whether it's time-ordered. And so I'm more comfortable saying things about local operator insertions, but I think the argument should go through for a general
state.
Actually there's an interesting check from ADS-CFT. So if I specialize to the case where I have just a deformation in the null direction, so delta x plus is non-zero, but delta x minus is zero, JLMS taught us how to calculate the modular Hamiltonian in ADS-CFT. They gave the following expression. So the modular Hamiltonian for some region A, which is the deformed region, is equal to the area operator, which is the area operator associated to the Ru Takayanagi surface, which is associated, or more generally, the HRT surface, which is associated to this region A. So here's a picture of this. This is my boundary. Here's my light cone on the boundary. Here's the Z direction, and inside there's some light cone here, and the Ru Takayanagi surface has some profile in here. So their expression has this area operator, but it also has the bulk modular Hamiltonian of bulk quantum fields. Okay. Now, if I take the full modular Hamiltonian, which is the difference between A and A complement, then this term, the area operator, cancels, and I just get the following statement, that the full modular Hamiltonian for A is equal to the full modular Hamiltonian for the bulk region AB, which is this region associated to the Ru Takayanagi surface, or the HRT surface. Basically, if so this is an equation for full modular Hamiltonians, for small deformations of full modular Hamiltonians, I claim that I can calculate both of these sides and check that it's consistent. So it's consistent with this JLMS, it doesn't prove this. Okay, so, and the reason it works our calculation plus JLMS implies the following condition. So the integral of the CFT stress tensor on the boundary over this null horizon is equal to the integral of the bulk stress tensor with some profile which is determined by the HRT surface over this bulk horizon. Actually, the equality follows of this statement follows basically from the standard rules of ADS-CFT. The bulk to boundary propagator for the stress tensor inserts a metric deformation, which is actually a shock wave. And so this shock wave has the following form. It has it's basically localized on the bulk horizon, and it has some profile. And it turns out that profile solves Einstein's equation. So this form solves Einstein's equation if the profile satisfies the HRT extremal surface condition. With some boundary conditions which are appropriate.
Sorry, so that proves the top statement?
Yeah, so this statement proves the top statement. This stress tensor deformation gives this shockwave metric, which then couples to the bulk metric and gives you this form. If you're more comfortable, this is basically the following Witten diagram. Okay, where the O operators are creating the state, and in the bulk they create some state as well, and then T plus plus integrated over the null horizon gives you this shock wave, which then couples to this through the stress tensor, to the bulk fields through the stress tensor. So actually, this is a result. This is, I should have said, this is basically a result of Hoffman-Molesina. So this is how they calculated the three-point functions in ADS-CFT. It was a surprise to me that this profile is this minimal. Maybe it's obvious to some people, but it's this extremal surface. So that's basically the end of the, so now the question is, can I go to higher orders? So that's a natural question. Actually, we've already gone to higher orders in some sense. So if you think about the shape deformation of the vacuum entanglement entropy I said before, we can do that for a Rindler space cut, right? And we have two deformations, delta x. So again, we have some kernel, and there's two deformations that you integrate over at second order. The first order deformation vanishes in vacuum. The second order deformation looks like this. You can write it in terms of these null coordinates, delta x plus delta x minus. And just by boost invariance around the original Rindler space cut, this is all you can write. And the coefficient that lies here, this entanglement density, turns out to be just the expectation value of these two null energy operators. So integral dx plus t plus plus and integral dx minus t minus minus. Now, we didn't realize this when we wrote the paper. We just put in the form of the two-point function, and we popped out the entanglement density. But if you go back and look at it, this is exactly what's happening.
Integral over the past and future horizon of the piece you have.
So and just to sort of finish, this kind of structure does seem to continue even at higher orders, but it gets a little bit more complicated. But roughly speaking, you just get correlation functions of these null energy operators.
Only e plus and e minus here.
I can tell you more after, because that's only very preliminary. So let me finish. So the monotonicity of relative entropy, so the conclusion is this monotonicity of relative entropy bounds CFD three-point functions, proves the ANIC, the average null energy condition for generators of bifurcate Killing horizons. Similar methods have been used to calculate perturbatively the shape deformation, entanglement entropy with relevant deformations, and they work out. The interesting thing about this new result is that in the previous cases, the answer was in some sense universal and coincided with ADS-CFT. So there was basically a check because we knew in ADS-CFT what the answer should be. But here we have kind of a new prediction. It's consistent with ADS-CFT, as I said, but it's not actually derived from ADS-CFT.
Being the
small deformation of the module Hamilton in terms of this null deformation. And so then it's interesting maybe to consider higher order deformations. You know, sort of very optimistically, you might be able to prove HRT in this way, very optimistically. That's it. Thanks.
Okay, so I'm a little confused. If we take the Schwarzschild solution and we look at a quantum field in the unruh state, so that's supposed to be the state that represents Hawking radiation.
Yeah.
You're supposed to think of that. I've always thought of it as sort of a flux of negative energy across the horizon, which if you include back reaction will cause the black hole to shrink.
Okay.
So you're telling me that has to satisfy the average null energy condition? I mean, it looks like it's negative energy all along the horizon.
You have to integrate over a complete null G desert.
Going back to the white hole.
You have to extend future horizon back past the now singular past horizon.
The unruh state, you say, is just singular, and in some sense, is infinitely positive on the past horizon,
in some sense,
which will cancel all the negative
So I think that's a case where the answer is divergent for what we're calculating, and so that's a state where we can't actually calculate this. So there is a condition on the state that the null energy is finite.
Interesting.
But do it for the smoother deformation of the Hartle-Hawking state.
Well, Hartle-Hawking, I mean, that's sort of equilibrium. So I would expect there to be...
So do Hartle-Hawking in asymptotically flat space, and then start with Hartle-Hawking, and then deform the boundary conditions on the scribe minus by turning off the ingoing flux at some finite place in some smooth way.
Okay.
That's a state which is going to approximate the unruh vacuum in the distant future.
Okay.
So that's a state to which this applies. So that's a regularization of the Unruh event.
So then we get, so along the white hole horizon, it's still in equilibrium, so there's sort of no net flux of energy across.
Yes,
it's
zero. Transition.
Okay. So it's all at the transition. You get some positive, something.
This is the same discussion we had with Don Page when he came through, where he was worried about his chat with Lenny about possibly.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. This is the same. Yeah. So two questions.
Yes.
One is, you know, people that want to use the ANAC to forbid time machines and all that.
Yeah.
Would like to prove what they call the achronal ANAC.
Yeah.
Which is kind of close to doing the ANAC on a bifurcated horizon, but doesn't have that extra structure around. So.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the obvious question is if you thought about that, and the obvious answer is it's awfully hard to imagine to apply the Euclidean methods, but I wonder if you have any comments.
No. I think that sort of seems a little bit hopeless just because we're using perturbation theory and we really need to start with a nice, you know, I think maybe something that we could try to get out of this is something like the generalized second law, because, you know, we're deforming the, you know, the bifurcation point a little bit in that case. So, but imagine just sort of if you can go to higher orders than perturbation theory, then maybe you could prove it more generally.
That was the next question. Can you imagine proving a GSL?
But you need to go to higher order. It kind of seems like the higher order calculation simplifies a lot when it's just a null deformation, but.
So why would the higher order calculation help you with the GSL?
If you can resum it maybe or something. I mean, it's not,
You're trying to get some information not just about the average of the stress tensor variance distribution. Is that And similarly, you know, people these days talk about the quantum null energy conjecture, or some people do.
It's much stronger.
Much more local.
Yeah, and much harder to prove because it depends on entanglement entropy. And so you need to make some statement about entanglement entropy for some general state, and I don't know how to do that. And so, you know, people have made some progress in ADS CFT where you can make some statement about the entanglement entropy.
Exactly.
Can I ask a small question?
Yeah.
What sense do we expect the proof of HRT, because that could only work for states that are geometric?
Let me qualify. For HRT in vacuum, so for vacuum of a CFT, just for general regions.
Okay.
So this method the value in maybe doing this is that it doesn't invoke the replica trick in any way.
One can partially answer David's question. I mean, you wouldn't start with that abstract characterization of which things you think are geometric, but the vacuum is geometric.
Yes.
And you expect that if you start with the vacuum and you apply sources to the vacuum of appropriate type where the ends are inserted the right way, that remains geometric.
Not quite.
Yeah.
That depends on the corresponding differential equation having a unique solution.
I would have given some Lorentz signature where I start with the vacuum and then apply sources to the boundary. If we have retarded Green's functions, everything has a unique solution.
No, because the things can scatter on the inside.
Yeah, they
can produce superpositions.
If I start with the equivalent of taking the classical ADS space and applying a non-trivial boundary condition, I expect it remains geometric.
We should talk.
So I think there is a perturbative way you can imagine.
Yeah, but it's perturbative, then it's.
Oh yeah, well, we're talking about perturbation.
Yeah, we're talking about. But actually, I don't know. You're imagining acting with like single trace operators on the vacuum or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how to do that actually in a perturbation theory. So
you don't have to do it.
No.
What do you mean?
The entanglement entropy for that state. Because it's not, in some sense, it's not perturbatively close to the vacuum state. So I mean, you made some progress looking at coherent states, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what you could do.
That's what I mean.
Ah, but no, I'm talking about
different kinds of things.
That's fine.
Coupling the CFT to a finite source.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Great, Tom. Thanks.